This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
You're on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9. That was Aretha Franklin's version of I Say a Little Prayer.
A standard. An oldie but a goodie.
It is. It's a beautiful song. And Aretha did it very nicely, I might add. We are joined in the studio by... I've lost my piece of paper. Jeff Munro. Someone's stolen it. Jeff Munro, hello. From the Community Alcohol Action Network.
Yeah, that's right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Who is the Community Alcohol Action Network? Who is it, like, under the auspices of a government, or what is it?
It's under the auspices of the Australian Drug Foundation,
right,
which is an organisation whose mission is the prevention of alcohol and other drug problems in Australia. So it's a non-government organisation. It's independent of government. We do get some funding through government, but also funding from private sources as well.
So how long has the network been going for, Jeff?
It's been going about 5 years, Leanne. Okay. We set it up at a time when the major focus on drug issues had been illegal drugs, and mm-hmm. we felt that, while that's important, alcohol had lost a lot of public attention, and we felt that while the industry had been deregulated for a number of years, as a society we were missing the fact that alcohol was causing immense problems and it was really going under the radar.
Yeah, and I guess being accepted in a lot of ways, that sort of fallout.
Indeed. I think, you know, we're very tolerant in Australia of drinking problems. We're very complacent about the problems, and we thought it was important to try to turn that around. And we've seen a bit of a swing in the last few years too, I think, where alcohol is being now recognised as a major social problem for Australia.
So I guess things like the tax, alcohol pops tax, that sort of thing?
Yeah, indeed.
Is an indication of that?
I think it is. While we would like a comprehensive approach to the problem, we have given that tax some support. Mm-hmm. Because taxation is one of the major, most effective ways in which governments can... try to reduce consumption, and in particular excessive consumption. And RTDs or alcohol pops are the most popular drink of underage girls in particular.
Yeah.
And we've seen a big rise in underage binge drinking, and so we think it's fair enough to try to make those a bit harder to access.
So it's very difficult to change behaviour, I guess, and change such a cultural...
Yes.
What sort of things does the sort of research show that works?
Well, look, the research is pretty clear cut from around the world. Taxation is up there number one.
So hit them in the hip pocket.
Which essentially makes the products more expensive to buy.
It does. That's right. And it means that even the heaviest drinkers will reduce their drinking.
Yep.
When it's more expensive. And we also know from research around the world that when you reduce consumption, you also reduce the harm. So that's very effective. Other very effective measures are reducing availability, mm-hmm. And that can be done through trading hours and days and so on. And in Australia, we've seen a deregulation of the trading hours in recent
so
decades.
So more available, more often, more
available,
more places.
Exactly. So people drink when it's more available.
Yeah, well, of course, because you could never, years ago, get a glass of wine at a cafe. Very common.
Yeah.
So it's there. Oh, yeah, I might have a glass of wine as opposed to, well, I'll have a cup of coffee.
Sure. And we probably don't see a lot of problems in cafes where people have a glass of wine with a meal or just have a glass of wine. But now you can sort of drink throughout the week, every 7 days, throughout the night, mm-hmm. right through. And so we were sort of promised when that happened that this would reduce drinking problems because people wouldn't have to engage in a swill at closing
time. The old 6 o'clock swill
or the 12 o'clock swill. And Tony Blair did the same thing in Britain a couple of years ago where he said, we'll have our pubs open 24 hours and this will knock out binge drinking. Well, Britain's got a bigger problem than we have, and it's even got bigger since they did that. So
people just continue to drink.
Some people just continue to drink right through.
So what's the official definition of binge drinking?
It's a good question. There really isn't an official definition. The one we talk about where people set out to get massively drunk.
Right.
So it's the intent to get drunk, which is very common amongst many drinkers in Australia. Mm. There's no recognised number of drinks. So, no. And I think that's important. That is where people set out to get drunk. Yep. And we have a sense in Australia and also in Britain and in Europe where a good proportion of young people in particular see getting drunk as entertainment. As
the objective.
Point, as the objective.
Yeah, for a good night
a
out.
A good night out means I'm going to get as wiped out as I can.
I can't remember the good night out.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
Are there any figures on whether it is more prevalent in certain age groups?
Oh, there's no doubt about that, yeah. Yes. Binge drinking really hits the peak in the 20s. Mm-hmm. 20 to 29 is the peak period, but obviously it starts and begins to develop in teenage years. And we've seen some signs of a growing problem in the teenage years where we now have 16-year-olds fronting up to treatment centres, for example, for alcohol problems, which means they've been drinking heavily for several years.
Yep.
So there's no doubt about that.
What work's being done on looking at why? You know, you don't just binge drink because it feels like a good idea. There's obviously stuff behind the behaviour.
Sure. This is quite complex too.
Yes.
Australia has a tradition, as we've talked about already, that it's part of the culture for many people to get drunk, and that's glorified in many ways through sport and other cultural sort of aspects. Lots of jokes about being drunk and so on. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressures on people to regard being drunk as fun and as an entertainment. But we also know that people who have emotional difficulties or who are struggling with life circumstances are also much more likely to use alcohol or other drugs as a way of coping. And so the young people we see may be having trouble at school or trouble at home for a whole lot of reasons. So that some people are at higher risk for those sorts of reasons. But I think we also need to work on the general acceptability of binge drinking.
Because I know looking at your website, some of the things that you talk about around using alcohol as, I guess, encourages to get people into venues, so like happy hours and providing free drinks and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's accepted behaviour. What sort of standards your network have on those sorts of things?
Well, look, we would like to see those disappear. I mean, we understand that everyone likes getting a freebie, mm-hmm. and it's nice to get two for one or whatever, but a lot of these gimmicks really do encourage people to drink more than they otherwise would, and in particular, the happy hours and so on, they encourage people to drink very quickly, and that leads to intoxication. So, and we think that feeds that sort of general notion that the idea is to drink as much as you can in a short time.
And especially after work, potentially, when you haven't had anything to eat.
So you have night drinks.
I was actually amazed to go to a bar to find that they did not sell any food whatsoever.
Yes.
You could not buy even a packet of chips over the counter.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to try and moderate your drinking with a little bit of food, you couldn't.
Yeah.
And obviously that's quite legal for a bar to do that, but I was quite stunned.
Yeah. I mean, we do a lot of work with local community-based sporting clubs where we encourage them and we have some models and some protocols about safe serving of alcohol.
Mm.
And we do advocate that they always serve food when they're serving alcohol because, one, it does put something in people's stomach, which reduces the ingestion of alcohol.
Yes.
But it also gives people something else to do rather than just drink.
Yeah,
so, that's right.
We think that the notion of safe serving needs to be much more widespread. And serving food and having non-alcoholic drinks is part of that.
Yeah.
So some of the things that have been happening around the city over the last few weeks, there's been quite a few high-profile incidents.
Yes, indeed.
And I guess it hasn't been specifically said that alcohol's played a part, but my guess is, everybody, there are pubs and these are vine things. The mix of alcohol and young men and violence, that just seems to be hitting some sort of peak.
Yes.
Is that a specific area that needs to be targeted, do you
think? I certainly think so. What we've seen in Melbourne, Melbourne is known now as having a very vibrant nightlife, and that's terrific, but it's also driven a great deal by alcohol. We've packed in a lot of venues now into Melbourne and concentrated them in small areas, and so there's competition amongst venues, and so there's more of a likelihood that they'll engage in those sorts of gimmicks, like, two for one.
Just get people through the door.
Or discount drinks, which we've seen.
I've seen ads where they've actually say women get free drinks, free champagne.
Yeah.
So it breaks, obviously balances out the genders in the straight clubs.
Well, that's right. We're concerned about that because that encourages women to drink more than perhaps they otherwise would. And we know that women are biologically more susceptible to the effects of alcohol.
Yep.
We were alarmed a couple of years ago to see a nightclub or you know, disco offering free drinks to women who wore a bikini.
Oh dear.
Free drinks all night. On the understanding that lots of blokes would follow and they would be drinking a lot, and that just seemed to be a recipe for disaster.
Yes, most definitely.
So we're really concerned about the pressures on venues not to serve responsibly and to engage in that sort of stupid competition.
Well, it was interesting with the owner of the hotel, or the manager of the hotel from last weekend's incident, who basically, I think I'm probably, might be misquoting, but basically I'm not involved. It's not my responsibility.
Yes. We're really concerned by the attitude of some nightclub bar managers and owners that, look, the solution is in having more police on the street, because we think that is really just duck shoving the issue.
Yep.
That if you're serving alcohol, you do have a responsibility. You have a legal responsibility, but you also have a duty of care to the people in your venue and the people outside the venue who might be affected by people who are drunk. So you can't simply wash your hands.
Yeah, and my understanding is that people that get their RSA, their responsible serving of alcohol certificate, part of it is about ascertaining when someone has had enough and you shouldn't serve them. But of course, if you're a poor bar staff person on the other side of the counter and you've got someone demanding a drink, it's a very difficult thing, obviously, to say, no, you've had enough. Look, particularly if that climate of, you know, violence and aggression is heightened.
Look, you're absolutely right. And the research, again, from around the world indicates that even if staff are well trained in responsible serving, they won't enforce it unless they know that they'll get the support of their manager and the licensee. And so the research has gone further to say that unless police are present and enforce the laws, then it's unlikely to be enforced. So there's no simple answer to this.
No, and I guess my sense too, like the government's tried the 2 a.m. lockout thing as an attempt to address the whole issue of late night violence at nightclubs. It all still sounds to me like Band-Aid stuff, if you like. And going back to what you were saying earlier, it's a cultural shift that we have to make in this country. I mean, it's very hard not to drink in Australia, isn't it?
It is.
If you're out to dinner even and you don't have a glass of wine, people kind of go, what's going on there?
Look, I think that's a really good point you've hit on. I mean, we have people who don't drink tell us that even their best friends still encourage them to drink and just don't understand or won't accept them not drinking. We have to end that. I mean, that is really quite unfair, apart from being dangerous.
And it's interesting that the sort of drink driving message, I think it's been very successful, the campaign, for a long time, even though we still hear about people being pulled over and the disappointment about those numbers. But I would say the majority of responsible people are now very aware about their intake. But then it's still that thing, but if you're not driving, then it sort of goes out the window.
That's right. It's probably the one area that you can get away with not having a drink if you say, I'm the designated driver.
Exactly.
So I'll have one glass.
Yeah.
But, you know, people still expect you to have one or be moderate as opposed to having none.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the rest of us who are in the car can think, well, we can drink as much as we like now because we've got the driver taken care of.
I had an interesting discussion the other day about how you stop somebody who you think's had too much to drink at a party or a dinner party or whatever, and how you get the car keys from them and not jeopardise your relationship or friendship with them. And that, you know, I mean, a lot of people get aggressive or I'll be right, or if you don't know them well enough to actually gauge.
Yes.
And how much you step into that sort of, I don't know. They're across the boundary, I guess. And that's a difficult one too. I mean,
You're not my mother.
That's right.
You know, you're not my teacher. Leave me alone kind of thing, as opposed to that sense of, well, I'm actually caring about you as one human being to another.
Yeah. And I think you're right. We do have to find ways in which we can intervene in those situations, you know, being confident and brave enough to do it.
Yeah.
Knowing that we are actually reducing the prospect of harm all around. And I'll come back to your point about, we have to do something about the general culture, because we also see now not just people getting drunk in bars and nightclubs, but people rolling into town now who are drunk already. That's called preloading, where people drink at home.
It's cheaper, and they've got the right buzz, and they're in the mood.
And so even if they don't enter the bar, they can be engaged in violence or other problems outside the premises. For example, in Brisbane now, the AHA is talking up there of installing breathalysers to breathalyse people before they come into the premises. Because there are so many people coming to the venue already drunk, and they're getting the blame for it.
Because I think there was something around the trains here, doesn't it? No, groups getting on at stations and being drunk on the trains, and that was sort of like causing havoc before they got into town.
I think that's an indication of our cultural problem, that, you know, we're determined to get drunk. for that night, and we'll do it at home before we come out. So,
find a way.
Yeah,
so as a society, we need to address that whole need we have to get drunk in terms of having a good time, don't we?
Yeah.
We're speaking with Jeff Munro, who's the Director of Community Alcohol and Action Network, which is under the auspices of the Australian Drug Foundation. Very shortly, we'll be joined by psychologist Ariane Lack, and maybe we can explore with Ariane some of those societal and personal issues that mean we have to get drunk to have a good time. So stay with us. You're on Saturday Magazine. Oh, a bit of sweet love on Saturday Magazine on Joy.
Very nice. Stevie Nicks and Michael Donald. Whenever I call you friend, Marg.
Lee, my friend. We've got a couple of good friends in the studio, Lee.
We have. We were talking before the break, and Jeff Munro is still here. Jeff is with us to talk about alcohol and its impact on the community and individuals. And we've had a chat about maybe some of the issues, some of the strategies, things that work, and the research. And at a broader level, just the Australian culture around drinking, and touched on what individually people may or may not do. And we're joined now by Ariane Lack, who's a psychologist. Good morning, Ariane.
Good morning,
thanks
Leanne.
For coming
Hi,
in.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good, Ariane. And you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Well, good.
So we've caught up. We've talked about Australian drinking, part of our culture, probably been causing problems for years, but it's been on the agenda, a bit more high profile now because of what's been going along around the sort of club scene. What are your views on it, Ariane?
Look, I think it's a really interesting topic. I've been working for about 13, 14 years as a psychologist, and, you know, drug and alcohol issues come up in my practice all the time, whether that is excessive alcohol use or illicit drugs or prescription drugs, which is quite common among some of the women that I see. Look, when you asked me to come in and have a talk about this, I did a bit of research, and there was a research paper called Beyond Perceptions, which Jeff is very familiar with because his organisation did it. And it was really interesting, some of the research that came out of that. It's from 2000, 2001
yes.
now?
Yes, a few years old now.
So, you know, when I was having a look at it, I was really struck by, there was, you know, of the, I think it was 517 people who were surveyed, about 50-60% were concerned about the level of alcohol and drug use in the gay, lesbian, trisexual, the, you know, lesbian etal community. But when it came to us as individuals, we weren't so concerned about our own drinking and drug use, which I think is interesting.
So it's a problem, but I'm okay.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that was really interesting was that about 10% of the participants considered that alcohol and drug use was an essential part of being gay, being part of the community. So I think if we're looking at doing some, you know, changes around culture and the way we think about drug and alcohol in general, but more specifically in the gay lesbian community, in our community, we need to be looking at why is that the case? You know, why is it that we think that it's an essential part of being gay?
So the whole gay thing is you should be drinking and taking drugs. That's all part of the part and parcel of it.
Yeah. I mean, there was certainly for men and women in the ages, I think it was about 30 to 39, they were, you know, considering it was an important part of being gay. And look, I think from, you know, what we know about anecdotally about coming out and also about some of the research in Beyond Perceptions is that, you know, there's a really high risk group of young people who are out there drinking and doing a lot of drugs in the time when they're first coming out. And this leaves them in, you know, real danger of, you know, they're not as informed as some of the, you know, the stalwarts of the community who've been out there doing the alcohol and drugs for a long time. And they're very vulnerable and
emotionally as well. I mean, Jeff was saying earlier that there are indications that people now are pre-loading, so before they go out. And I guess for younger people too, it's probably easier to access alcohol at home or get someone to drop it off rather than go into a licensed bar or whatever.
Particularly if you're underage. Look, I remember I'm only 36, 37, you know.
So you're right in that group, yes.
I remember doing that, you know, get get your friends down to the local bottle shop, the ones who had a license or whatever, yeah. and they'd go and buy all the alcohol and you'd all, you know, have a wow of a time before you went out and tried to get into the nightclubs underage.
And be drunk when you turned up.
That's yeah. right, exactly.
And it was perfectly acceptable, which I guess brings Absolutely. Us to that whole thing about our own personal responsibility and societal responsibility. We actually had a couple of messages in, one from Joe, who is from Heavenly Solutions, which and Heaven's Door, which is down in Commercial Road, I think, who was actually very very pleased to hear that we've taken that balanced view that it's not only the nightclub's fault. Like, there's, you know, been a lot of nightclub bashing, if you like, about, you know, the nightclubs are all to blame. But obviously we choose to pick up the glass and take that drink. And we do, as individuals in society, have to take that personal responsibility. On the other hand, we had a message in following that from Matt, who was at a nightclub, was out last night, he doesn't say where, and both times he ordered a glass of Coke, he was offered a shot of alcohol to go with it. And he felt quite shocked. He's an ex-bar attendant and just feels like that's not a great way to do. But obviously, again, that bar attendant is under pressure for, you know, would you like fries with that, essentially, isn't it? It's that business thing of add on. As you were saying earlier, that's, Jeff, it's a competitive market out there. You've got to find some way.
And we also talked about how hard it is for people not to drink. And there's another perfect expression of that, where we just don't listen to people who don't want to drink.
That's
so
right.
It's complex, isn't it? There's no easy answer.
No, there isn't. I think the other interesting thing is, I mean, we all know that alcohol is a social lubricant, basically. You know, you know, for eons, you know, human beings have used alcohol as a way to, you know, make the relationships between other people, particularly in new and different situations, a bit smoother and a bit easier. And, you know, alcohol, not only is it a depressant, but it does affect our, you know, social... the social part of our brain, and also the part of our brain that is responsible for being able to make, you know, sensible decisions. And one of the things that, you know, I find in my practice is that, you know, a lot of people who are drinking, and I'm not talking about people who go out and have a glass of wine or a couple of, you know, bottles with their friends for dinner. I'm talking about people who are consistently drinking to a problematic level that's getting in the way of their occupational, you know, goals and their social relationships and their family relationships, are putting themselves or getting themselves into really dangerous situations where they're even more at risk of, you know, further emotional damage.
I don't believe about alcohol as a depressant. I'll make myself feel better, I'll have a glass of alcohol, which in fact in the long run it has the opposite effect, doesn't it? But our mental approach is, I'll have a drink, that'll make me feel better.
Which
probably does for a very short period of time. So I'm interested in the clients that come to you. What sort of situations have they, what's been the turning point, what's prompted them to come to you and say, it's probably not just, I don't walk in and say, I've got a problem with alcohol.
But what's, very rarely.
What sort of things do they come to you with?
Look, it can be anything from having a catastrophic relationship breakup to a near miss of physical injury or death, right through to, you know, it's... my wife or my partner has told me that, you know, she's going to leave if I don't do something about my drinking. And what we know from research is that, one of the really useful screening questions for professionals to find out if somebody does have a drinking problem is to ask them, has anyone ever told you they think you have a problem with drinking? And this is a really, apparently it's a very reliable tool to screen to see whether somebody, you know, may be at risk of having a drug or alcohol problem. So there's some of the reasons that people come along. Other people are just, you know, they've got to a point in their life where the cumulative, they're just not happy with their life. They, you know, they see that there are many aspects of their life where they're not where they would like to be, and they've made a decision for whatever reason that this is it. They're going to do something about it. And I think one of the things that I see so often in my practice is that for people who, you know, there's a reason why people drink too much.
Yeah,
we don't just do it because it makes us feel great or it makes us feel better. There's a reason we do it. My professional opinion about that is that we often we're human, we experience feelings that are quite difficult, and if we have a period of time where we're overwhelmed by difficult feelings, or if we've not ever been able to develop the skills to be able to manage those difficult feelings sometimes, and we're introduced to alcohol so early,
yeah,
and we go, oh, actually that feels pretty good. I don't have to worry. I can just zone out and not have to deal with these difficult things that are going on in my life. And this can be where the association between emotional problems and alcohol start.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that people who are, consistently taking alcohol or other drugs are just not emotionally available to other people in their lives. They're not emotionally available to themselves because they're constantly in this altered state of being. It makes it much more difficult to access how they're feeling, and and that's in part one of the reasons why people do it.
That's right.
But if we're not able to access how we're actually feeling, it's very difficult for us to identify what our needs are as human beings, and that makes it really difficult for us to get our needs met in relationships.
Yeah. On Saturday Magazine, we're speaking with Ariane Lack and Jeff Munro about the issues surrounding alcohol. Ariane, I think from what you're saying too, I suppose it's, we don't have an understanding sometimes of the role that alcohol plays in our lives, that does things like mask our emotions, prevent us from being emotionally available to the people that we want to be available to, and all those things. Jeff, education, is that part of the solution, helping us to understand better alcohol and all of the issues surrounding it?
I think it is, Marg, but I think it's a community-wide education, not simply limited to schools, because we've been doing that in schools for decades.
Yes, and I guess I mean that broad, we all can do some education.
Yeah, indeed, and I think we've seen that work really well with smoking, where we've had a community-wide campaign with professionals and community activists over 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm. A very hard-hitting campaign. I mean, telling it like it is, really.
In the end it was, but it started out, I think, fairly moderate.
Yeah.
But it's got perhaps harder-hitting as the years have gone on, and we've had a better understanding. And I think the Drink Drive campaign is another good example where over 20 to 30 years we've changed our attitudes towards drink driving. And so that's been a community-wide education that's included schools and universities, but also included social marketing campaigns through the media, backed up by professionals. And so I think we do need that with alcohol. I think we're getting to the stage now where we are beginning to recognise that we do need to do something quite profound, because we're not making much headway at the moment.
Mm. So what's the Australian Drug Foundation working on in that regard at the moment?
Well, we've been looking at the way in which alcohol is marketed and advertised, and we've been advocating for a change to the advertising code. We don't think it works very well at all where it's regulated by the alcohol industry. We'd like to see a much tougher code introduced. We'd like to see a much tougher enforcement of serving practices, because even though the bars and nightclubs aren't totally responsible, as we've said already, they do play a big role in setting the local culture. And we'd like to see governments play a much bigger role in terms of social marketing and undertake the sort of comprehensive long-term educational campaigns that we've seen around drink driving and smoking. Not to advocate, obviously, that people shouldn't drink, but to moderate the drinking culture so we understand that we can have a good time without going over the top.
I think I completely agree, and I think that we as a community can bring that back down to us as individuals is also about being responsible for the people that we're with when we go out.
Indeed.
I think you mentioned earlier on that loading up and binge drinking can be a form of entertainment, and in actual fact it's entertainment at the expense of somebody else. Being able to go out and drink safely requires not just one person, but the whole group that you're going out with at the time to actually be monitoring and checking on people and making sure that, everyone's okay.
Well, I think that's right. I think we should see that sort of safe or moderate drinking as a skill, because you do need a fair bit of skill to do it, because it's easy once you start. You've had
that's
a couple,
right.
You feel a bit smoother. It's easy to continue on, and it takes quite a deal of skill to be in a group and to be drinking without going to the point of being drunk or out of it. So
exactly. Or bringing it to someone else's attention or something like that.
Yeah, there's
like
some
that.
Wonderful strategies that you can use by, you know, pre-contracting with friends before you go out and say, look, I'm only planning to have, you know, 5 drinks. After I have more than 5 drinks, if I'm going for another one, can you tell me to stop? If I cut up rough, then take me home.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's a whole lot of strategies that can be put into place that, you know, you can use as an individual or as in the group that you're going out with to actually make sure and keep everybody in your group safe. The other thing that I wanted to mention a bit was drink spiking, because that's also another issue that's come across my my couch, if you like. And that... you know, there's a lot of, particularly for women, there's a lot of anxiety about drink spiking in clubs and pubs and venues these days, and even at restaurants and stuff. If you're out in a big party and there's a big, you know, gathering going on,
so that's other people within the group or strangers coming along and
just
dropping something in.
And I suppose mates going, look, we'll chuck a vodka in there, just lighten them up a bit.
Yep.
Had a rough week. We'll help them along.
Exactly.
We've probably got a minute each before we have to wrap it up. And you know, it's been a fascinating discussion, and obviously one that we can go on and on with, and we may well continue at some future date. But how do we take care? How do we start to make that change from each of you, just very briefly? And I know that's a really hard thing to ask.
You can go first, Jeff.
Okay, look,
25 words or less.
I'm happy to say that even though we're undertaking various programs and we're advocating and we're working with government and other people, in the end it does come down to us. And that's something we can all do, regardless of what the greater forces are. We can all take the decision to be much more careful about the way we drink.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.